The Professions and Public Health Subcommittee will come to order. Erin, please call the roll.
Chair Robinson.
Here.
Representatives Andrade. Arrington.
Here.
Guerrero.
Here.
Escamani.
Here.
Fernandez-Barkeen. Garrison.
Here.
Gottlieb.
Here.
Maggard.
Here.
McLean.
Here.
Rayner.
Here.
Rizzo. Rommel.
Here.
Saroy.
Here.
Skidmore. Smith.
Here.
Snyder.
Here.
Tuck.
Here.
A quorum is present, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Erin. Good morning, everyone. I want to remind everyone to please silence their cell phones because we have a nice big agenda here. We're going to hear six bills and one proposed committee substitute. So we're going to move right into it. First up is HB 1073, Newborn Screenings by Representative Lupus. Representative, you're recognized to explain your bill.
Thank you, Chair Robinson. Good morning, committee. It's great to see everyone. Chair Robinson, before I start, I just want to thank you for bringing this bill up and for staff for their help in this. Members, I'll give you a little bit of a surprise. You're going to have the cutest public testimony you've seen all session today with this bill, so just know that that is coming. But if you haven't had a chance to have Teresa Bulger in your office over the last 4 years, then you need to do it. One of the joys of serving has been my opportunity to meet so many of the families in my district with children who have hearing impairments, and the work that she's doing and so many of our constituents are doing across the state to address those challenges. Members, what this bill seeks to do is to provide an additional layer of protection for our youngest children to make sure that we ensure that they have everything that they can to ensure that they don't have hearing impairments moving forward. So what this bill does is that in the instance of a child being born in a hospital, at a birthing center, at home, that a child is given the hearing screening, which is statutorily required. If there's an issue with the hearing screening, that child will then be tested for congenital cytomegalovirus, which is a disease that can impact long-term hearing outcomes for children. If that comes back, then the parent can decide whether or not they want to treat that child with the antivirus. So what this bill essentially does is require that additional layer of protection to ensure that we're doing everything we can to ensure that these children, have access to all the information, the parents have access to all the information, and then we can address these hearing impairments. That is the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Having explained his bill, any questions for Representative Lupus? Waiting for the cute part.
It's coming.
Okay.
It's not me.
Okay.
What if it was me? You guys would be really disappointed.
Seeing no questions from members. Public testimony. Do we have any public appearance cards? Oh, we do? Okay. Seeing no questions, we have an amendment. Representative Lupus, you're recognized to explain your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this amendment was done in consultation with the Pediatrician Association, just addressing the deadlines for the referral process.
Any questions on the amendment? Representative Rommel, you're recognized.
Thank you, Representative. Is this the cute portion?
Representative Lupus, you're recognized.
That's for your own interpretation.
Further questions on the amendment? Seeing none, do we have any testimony on the amendment? We do. Teresa Bulger, Florida Academy of Audiologists.
Waves in support.
Waves in support. Labia Alina Nijas, Families of Kids Who Are Deaf. There we go. You are recognized.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Dr. George Nijas, and I'm here with my wife, Libya. We're here today with our son, Ignacio. Ignacio is deaf. Upon receiving our son Ignacio's diagnosis, we quickly educated ourselves as how we can give him the opportunity to communicate and develop as similarly as possible to his typical hearing peers. More so, we learned that hearing is ultimately achieved with the brain and that unaided deafness in a developing child is a neurological emergency. While hearing aids give our son access to sound, it is his attendance to an auditory oral school that teaches him to identify, understand, produce sound, and most significantly, language.
Our family would like to thank the Florida legislature for your support of Ignacio and other children with hearing loss, and specifically auditory oral programs like the one Ignacio attends in Miami. We'd like to thank Representative Alupis for bringing awareness to the issue of congenital CMV and the need for screening. Thank you also to the committee for hearing the bill. This is an important issue for many parents of children with hearing loss, We hope this bill will bring more awareness to the issue and improve outcomes for children. Ignacio, do you want to say thank you? Get a seat. Thank you.
Thank you.
Y bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Say bye-bye.
Okay. No, bye-bye.
Thank you, and bye-bye.
Thank you.
That is definitely the cute part of the agenda. Doug Bell, you have a tough act to follow. Doug Bell, Florida chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Waves in support. That's all the public testimony I have on the amendment. Any debate? Members on the amendment? Representative Lupus, you're recognized to close in your amendment.
Wave closed, Chair.
Wave closed. Show the amendment adopted without objection. We are now on the bill as amended. We do have some public appearance cards on the bill as amended. Doug Bell, pediatricians, waves in support. Jim McGill, USF Health, waves in support. Delina Barajos of the Debbie School. Waves in support. Ignacio Chernanas.
Waves in
support. Waves in support. George Nahas.
Wave in support.
Waves in support. Cedric Pritchett, Normas Children's Health. Sir, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Esteemed members of the Professions in Health, Public Health Subcommittee. It's a pleasure to be here and speak just a few words on behalf of this bill here, 1073. As a pediatric otolaryngologist and an individual in the healthcare community who is dedicated to taking care of children with hearing loss, I get to hear daily the frustrations, challenges, goals that our families actually bring. Approximately 1.5 to 2 children per 1,000 are born with permanent hearing loss here in Florida. And approximately 5 in 1,000 are born with congenital CMV, almost twice the rate of our hearing loss. This can be a devastating diagnosis. It can lead to seizure, blindness, deafness, cerebral palsy, and sometimes, unfortunately, death. But it can also be a hidden and fairly innocuous condition. CMV is a virus that can be transported from mother to baby. CMV is the most common cause of infectious permanent hearing loss in the state and around the world. This particular piece of legislation will result in early identification of CMV. This will allow an explanation for the hearing losses, cognitive delays, and poor performance that otherwise will go unknown. It will allow us to identify children who are at higher risk, facilitating delivery of their resources so critical for their language and development. And finally, it will provide qualifications for medications that in some cases can reduce, reverse, and prevent further deterioration of their hearing loss. This bill masterfully combines the existing infrastructure of our statewide newborn hearing system screening and will use targeted testing to identify CMV as a part of that. This will improve the ability of our children to receive and achieve the outcomes, maximizing their learning potential. Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. Samantha Isaacs. Ma'am, you're recognized.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Samantha Isaacs, and I am here in support of House Bill 1073. Today, I'm here as one mother representing thousands across the state of Florida. In May of 2015, my son Henry was born via planned C-section, and our lives were forever changed. What we thought was just a happy, healthy, 7-pound, 4-ounce, beautiful baby boy was not. Hours after Hank was born, he was administered the newborn hearing screening, as indicated by federal law. He failed. We tried again shortly thereafter, and he failed. And shortly before discharge, we tried one more time, and he failed. There were no excuses or reasons given, and we were just told to follow up with our pediatrician and see an audiologist in 2 weeks. No information, no warnings. In August of 2015, Hank was diagnosed with sensory neural hearing loss. He's deaf. He's been deaf since birth. The ENT recommended that we see a genetic counselor because we have no history of family hearing loss. In a course of 6 months, I had a baby who was diagnosed as deaf, and we sat in the office of our genetics counselor's office as she told us the devastating news that our son had been born with congenital CMV and would lead a lifetime of disability. I was devastated and confused and felt let down back then. But the years have passed, and I'm standing here today so much stronger than I was back then. I'm a mom who demands change, and I won't stop until that happens. Today, Hank is 6 years old. He is a team of nearly 13 physicians and therapists. Hank has profound hearing loss, cortical vision impairment, a rare brain malformation, failure to thrive, spastic, quadriplegic cerebral palsy. He's nonverbal and requires care for all daily activities. The list goes on, but I won't because I think it's clear what I'm saying. Hank was nearly one before we were able to receive physical, occupational, or speech therapies. He was two before the Division of Blind Services and the School for the Deaf and Hard of Hearing began services with us. This late diagnosis of CMV caused us to have a late start in life receiving therapies. If the newborn blood screenings and the hearing tests are required to identify infants who need early access to interventional services, shouldn't they be doing just that? This bill addresses that very clearly, that infants who have hearing loss may have a congenital CMV infection and need to identify it early so they can receive that early start. I thank you for your time, and I urge you to vote yes on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Brian Jordis, Florida Association of Healthy Start Coalition, waves in support. David Mika, Florida Hospital Association, waves in support. Edeline Joseph Theopline, Florida PTA, waves in support. That's all the public testimony cards I have, members. We are in debate. Anyone, Representative Escomani, you're recognized in debate.
Thank you so much, Chair. I just want to say thank you to all the testimony. It's so incredibly powerful, and we're grateful that you took the time to come up here. So truly, thank you. Representative Lupus, great bill. I spoke to some of my local folks about it too. And actually, the only thing I'll lift up for members is it reminds me of a conversation I had with my director of public health in Orange County around not just issues around hearing loss, but also HIV. Because if you don't identify HIV early in a pregnancy, you're unable to prevent it for the new child. And many hospitals have protocols in place to try to do an HIV test as well. But it reminded me of that issue because it's very reflective of what you are working to do, is try to have that early detection. And in the case of HIV, we can prevent HIV from being transferred to a newborn if we identify it early. And so thanks for this intentional effort to make a difference, and I'll be proudly voting yes on the bill.
Representative Rayner, you're recognized in debate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Rep. Lupus, for this bill, and thank you so much for having a cute part but a powerful part of her testimony, and all the other public speakers. Thank you so much for traveling up here and sharing with us. I really like this bill. You know, I'm always about making sure that our children have the best start and what they need. I do would like for you, in your closing, if you could just possibly address once children are diagnosed with a hearing or CMV issue, especially if parents don't really have resources, what are the next steps? Because I also think once they have the diagnosis, but making sure that all parents have access to the resources, they need to make sure, like immediately, as the speaker was saying. And if you could just address that for me, that would be great. But of course, I'm voting up on it. And I appreciate you, all the work you do on behalf of our kids.
Further debate. Seeing none, Representative, thank you so much for this bill. I think there's a theme with your bills. They have a heart, and this bill has a heart. I know you have a heart for this issue and a number of issues, but I thank you for your passion on this topic, and you're recognized to close in your bill.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Committee. Ignacio, it's unbelievable. And to everyone who came, thank you so much. It means so much to all of us to hear your story. Members, you know, one in every 200 children born in this country has CMV. And, you know, you may hear people come to you and talk about the costs of this and is this overly burdensome. I think this is the least we can do to ensure that parents have what they need to make sure that they can make the best decisions for their children. And Representative Rayner, to your question, you know, this bill is really about providing parents notice. So if a parent is notified that their child does have, if they fail their hearing test and they do have CMV, the parents can then decide whether or not they want to put the child on the antivirals. If we don't have this notice, then you hear stories like we've heard today. So I think that's why this is so important. So again, to everyone who was here today, I really appreciate it and would ask for your support.
Representative Lupus, having closed on his bill, Aaron, please call the roll on HB 1073 and announce the vote.
Representatives Andrade?
Yes.
Harrington?
Yes.
Barrero?
Yes.
Escamani?
Yes.
Fernandez-Barkeen?
Yes.
Garrison?
Yes.
Gottlieb?
Yes.
Maggard?
Yes.
McLean? Rayner?
Yes.
Rizzo?
Yes.
Rommel?
Yes.
Saroy?
Yes.
Skidmore?
Yes.
Smith?
Yes.
Snyder?
Yes.
Tuck?
Yes.
Chair Robinson?
Yes.
17 yeas and zero nays, Mr. Chairman.
Please show the bill reported favorably as amended. Congratulations.
Thank you, committee. I'll be bringing Ignacio for all of my bill presentations for the rest of the
session. Very smart, very smart.
Have a great day.
I'm going to pass the gavel to Vice Chair Snyder.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Up next for consideration will be House Bill 593, Telecommunicator Cardiopulmonary Resuscitation by Representative Trabulsi. Representative Trabulsi, you are recognized to present the bill.
Thank you, Vice Chair Snyder, Ranking Member Smith, and committee members. I think Ignacio is going to stay here for my bill presentation, too. Maybe we'll take him on the floor with us today. It would be great. I think it's great that I'm able to present this bill today because we are celebrating Florida Heart Advocacy Day here at the Capitol. So this just makes sense. Only 1 in 10 victims of a heart attack outside of a hospital environment survive, but with delivery of CPR by bystanders, chances of survival increase 2 to 3 times. HB 593 adds a requirement for 911 dispatchers to be trained in telecommunicator CPR so that they may provide instant instructions to bystanders to begin CPR until first responders arrive on site. This training is available through multiple different providers, including several free options. Public safety agencies also have the flexibility to enter into a reciprocal agreement with another call center who has the training to provide the telecommunicator CPR instead. And that is the bill.
Thank you, Representative Trabulsi. Having explained the bill, we are in questions. Seeing no questions, move into public testimony. Richard Pinsky, 911 emergency dispatchers, waves in support. Tiffany McCaskill Henderson, American Heart Association, wishes to speak. Welcome, Ms. Henderson. You are recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members. Thank you to Representative Trabulsi for bringing this good legislation forward, life-saving legislation, and also thanks to Representative McClure, who signed on as a co-sponsor. The American Heart Association is in full support. We know that when CPR, hand to chest, is started immediately, as Representative Trabulsi said, it can double or even triple the chances of survival in a cardiac arrest event. 911 dispatchers and telecommunicators are a critical link in the cardiac arrest chain of survival. This legislation will ensure that they are properly and accurately trained to give high-quality CPR instructions over the phone, coach callers through CPR, in those critical minutes prior to EMS arriving on the scene. So we kindly ask that you support this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. Tony Large, Florida College of Emergency Physicians and the Florida Society of Respiratory Care, waves in support. Marnie George, Florida Chapter, American College of Cardiology, waves in support. Thank you. Members, we are in debate. Any debate on the bill? Seeing no debate, Representative Trabulsi, you are recognized to close on your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. I would just like to say I've used this scenario before, but I know CPR. But I think in an event where I had to witness someone having a heart attack, that I might lose it a little bit and need someone on the other side of the line to guide me through it so that I could use the skills that I've been trained for in order to help save a life. And I think that is just what this bill will do. And I would appreciate your support.
Thank you, Representative Trabulsi. Having closed on the bill, Aaron, please call the roll and announce the vote.
Representatives Andrade?
Yes.
Arrington?
Yes.
Barrero?
Yes.
Escamani? Fernandez-Barkeen?
Yes.
Garrison?
Yes.
Gottlieb?
Yes.
Maggard?
Yes.
McLean? Rayner?
Yes.
Rizzo?
Yes.
Rommel?
Yes.
Saroy?
Yes.
Skidmore?
Yes.
Smith?
Yes.
Snyder?
Yes.
Tuck?
Yes.
Chair Robinson? 17 yeas and 0 nays, Mr. Vice Chair.
So the bill reported favorably. Up next, we will have Representative Altman, consideration of PCS for House Bill 937, non-emergent patient care. Representative Altman, you are recognized to explain the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Acute hospital care at home programs allow hospitals to provide inpatient level and acute and restorative care to patients in their homes. These programs are authorized under a waiver from the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, and additional waivers from ACA. Several hospitals in Florida have received the CMS waiver and are operating or developing programs, including Mayo Clinic, Tampa General, and Health First. This House Bill 937 addresses some of the regulatory issues to help these programs serve patients more safely and efficiently by allowing paramedics to perform required in-home visits under the supervision and protocol of a physician and allow hospital pharmacies to dispense medicine to these patients. The PCS defines acute hospital care at home. The bill defines community paramedicine and provides for the provisions for pharmacies to dispense medicine in the home. And that's the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Altman. Having explained the bill, we are in questions. Members, any questions? Seeing none, we are in public testimony. Dr. Michael Minucci with the Mayo Clinic. Waves in support. Jan Gorey with Tampa General Hospital. Waves in support. And David Micah with the Florida Hospital Association. Waves in support. We are in debate. Anyone wishing to debate the bill? Representative Altman, you're recognized to close on your bill.
Wave close.
Having closed on your bill, Aaron, please call the roll for PCS for House Bill 937 and announce the vote.
Representatives Andrade?
Yes.
Arrington?
Yes.
Barrero?
Yes.
Escamani?
No.
Fernandez-Barquin?
Yes.
Garrison?
Yes.
Gottlieb?
Yes.
Maggard?
Yes.
McLean? Rayner?
Yes.
Rizzo?
Yes.
Rommel?
Yes.
Saroy?
Yes.
Skidmore?
Yes.
Smith?
Yes.
Snyder?
Yes.
Tuck?
Yes.
Chair Robinson?
Yes.
16 yeas and 1 nay, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Aaron. So the proposed committee substitute reported favorably. Congratulations. And with that, hand the gavel back to our chairman. Thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair. Representative Altman, you are recognized to explain House Bill 1101, Anesthesiologist Assistance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 1101 is a modernization of Florida Certified Anesthesiologist Assistant practice, which is found in Florida Statutes 458 and 459. The proposal consists of revisions which make both the administrative and substantive changes that are necessary to operate these programs efficiently. Now, this hurts a little bit. The current statutes were passed by the Florida legislature in 2005 and have not been modernized since then. Of course, I was here in 2005, so it kind of makes me feel unmodern. But we had lengthy discussions. Dr. Homan from Tampa and a surgeon ran the bill. It was thoroughly vetted, and this program has worked magnificently. The changes are very simple. It adds the term osteopathic as an anesthesiologist because osteopathic doctors can be anesthesiologists. So a very technical change that's necessary. It revises the definition of direct supervision to better represent the current definition adopted and used by the Florida Department of Health and the Florida Board of Medicine. The new language makes it clear that a CAA may perform the tasks listed in statute and those detailed in a written protocol under the direct supervision of an anesthesiologist. And these protocols are quite detailed. This language is administrative in nature and removes the requirement of a sworn statement during a license renewal process. That sworn statement has been problematic, especially in times of COVID, and now it allows it to be done remotely. And that's the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Altman, having explained his bill, members, we have any questions? Representative Rizzo, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative. And I, on face value, I really like the bill. There is one concerning portion of it to me, and I just need edification, please. In the summary analysis, we talk about that the bill also authorizes anesthesiologist assistants to personally administer prescribed anesthetic under the direct supervision of an anesthesiologist. It also goes on to say that the bill revises the direct supervision requirements by requiring supervising anesthesiologists to be reasonably physically available to an anesthesiologist assistant as needed. So my question is, number one, under what sort of procedures are we talking about that this new authority may exist for anesthesiologist assistants? And also, what does reasonably physically available mean?
And I will note before Representative Altman answers the question, I believe one of those two issues will be addressed in the amendment. But Representative Altman, you're recognized to answer the question.
Good question. First and foremost, it's important to note that these anesthesiology assistants have extensive training. They're highly, highly specialized in the administration of anesthesiologies and the protocol of working directly under that anesthesiologist's supervision. The way the old language can be interpreted, and it's somewhat interpretive, it almost means that the anesthesiologist has to be right almost there in the same room. Why have an assistant? The reasonable requirement in close proximity means they must be there on campus, they must be near, they must be there pretty fast, and to meet the medical standards in that care. And so typically that means that they can be there almost immediately. Doesn't mean they're right there in the room, but they must be able to be there in time enough to render the assistance that's necessary. Keep in mind, the person that's administering that anesthesiologist is highly trained and is going through a lot of rigors in testing and licensure. But that reasonable is the basically, if you were to define that standard, any standard of care that would allow an anesthesiologist to be there in time to render aid and care in any situation. If I may use an example. My wife, we had a little emergency in the birth of our first child. It was amazing. Thank God everything worked out. It was amazing how rapidly that room filled with people at the hospital. I mean, it was within, if not seconds, if not minutes, seconds. That's the standard of care. But it doesn't mean all those people were standing in that room watching the labor take place. They were down the hall or maybe one flight of stairs, but they were close enough to render the care necessary to make sure that delivery went well. And that's the standard of care. This doesn't reduce that. It's that reasonable time that reasonably can be provided to make sure that patient doesn't have harm.
You're recognized, Representative Rizzo, for a follow-up.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for that explanation. So, and just to maybe drill down a little more on this. So there's no schedule of say procedures. I'm going to assume that all of this is under general anesthesia, but is there any sort of schedule as far as, for example, that it may be allowed, the assistant may be allowed to be the sole person administering and monitoring the anesthesia during the procedure? If, say, for example, we're talking about a buccal tumor versus an open heart surgery or an organ transplant, is there any sort of distinction?
Representative Altman, you're recognized.
I know that hospitals, emergency anesthesiologists, MDs, surgeons, all operate under certain protocols and procedures and standards of care. And they're different. Obviously, an open heart surgery would be a different standard of care and lesser type of surgeries. It would be impossible for us as legislators to try to legislate all these standards of care. We have high standards, not to mention the liability exposure that doctors practice under, that address those detailed standards and how you treat. And every procedure is different, whether it's open heart or wart removal. They are all different. And our highly trained physicians, our hospitalists, our hospitals, our medical professionals and paraprofessionals operate under those. I don't think this in any way sacrifices those or in any way would jeopardize those and would allow any sort of deviation from the standard of care that patients are already getting.
Representative Rayner, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And hello, Representative Altman. I just wanted to kind of start with my first base question. When we're thinking about anesthesiologist assistants, what type of educational requirements do they have in order to become an assistant, especially if we're thinking about expanding their scope of work?
Representative Altman, you're recognized.
Well, they have to be licensed as an anesthesiology assistant in the state. They must complete a training program accredited by the Commission of Accredited or Allied Health Education Programs, pass an examination established by the National Commission on Certification of Anesthesiology Assistants, be certified in advance cardiac life support, submit an application fee, a certificate of completion, and approved graduation level program. They extensive background checks. They must hold a current certificate issued by the National Commission on Certification of Anesthesiologist Assistants or complete 40 hours of continuing education every 2 years. So not only have to be trained, but they have some significant continuing education as well. And again, always under the supervision of an anesthesiologist.
Representative Rayner, you're recognized for a follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you so much, Representative Altman, for that answer. And with that in mind, and this may be somewhat similar to Representative Rizzo's question, and so if you've answered it, I apologize for asking again. So when we're thinking about the different types of anesthesia that cases they may be involved in, you know, you mentioned it could be something as simple as a wart or something as significant as, you know, open heart surgery. Does this bill kind of allow them to be involved in every type of surgery case or every type of medical case, whether it's something very simple or something very, very, very complex?
Representative Altman, you're recognized.
I think that call would be the administering, the supervising surgeon, physicians, the hospitals that write procedures. I'm not aware of a situation where an CAA could not operate. There may be. That's going to be the call of the surgeon and the anesthesiologist. I mean, there's more than one doctor in a room in surgery, and you always have the surgeon, and you always have the anesthesiologist and the assistants who's helping that anesthesiology.
Ranking Member Smith, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Altman. I have some questions about the strike call, but we'll get there in a minute. Wanted to know if the bill in any way creates any kind of billing conflicts with CMS. I know that they usually have regulations, certainly with billing and reimbursements for AAs.
Representative Altman, you're recognized.
Rephrase that, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry about that. So I'm hearing from some advocates that the bill creates conflicts with CMS billing practices. And so I understand that they have a number of guidelines, interpretive guidelines for anesthesia services. So I'm curious if you've heard the same and what your response is to some of these potential CMS billing conflicts.
Representative Altman, you're recognized.
I'm not aware of that. There may be somebody who's confronted that here, but I'm not, that hasn't been brought to my attention.
Okay, thank you.
Ranking Member Smith for a follow-up. You're recognized.
Thank you, I'm good.
Oh, you're good. Any further questions? We have an amendment. Let's move right into that. Representative Altman, you're recognized to explain your amendment, barcode 833519.
This addresses some of the concerns, ensuring that anesthesiologists are there and able to apply, and it prevents an anesthesiologist assistant from prescribing any sort of anesthesia without that direct attention. It's more of a technical and more of an assurance that that will not happen.
Members, questions? Ranking Member Smith, I know you had some questions. You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a strike-all amendment. I mean, you say it's a technical amendment, but my question is how does this definition of direct supervision, how stringent or not stringent is the definition compared to other states and how they treat AAs?
Representative Altman, you're recognized.
It's very similar to those other states, as well as very similar to those other practices that use medical assistance.
Ranking Member Smith, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Altman. Are you aware of any other states that define direct supervision for AAs the precise way that you're defining it here?
Representative Altman, you're recognized.
Well, we have 650 certified anesthesiologist assistants here in Florida, which is the second most licensed state behind Georgia for CAA licensure, and we're similar to Georgia.
Ranking Member Smith, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know that this is different from the original definition. The original definition said that the direct supervision was the anesthesiologist had to be reasonably available. So in practice, I'm curious, how does this definition change? What would be considered direct supervision compared to the original definition, reasonably available, which you acknowledged was, some folks had concerns, was broad?
Well, you're recognized.
Let me point out one thing. The explanations I gave you for the bill actually included the strike all as well. So it would be the same in my definition and presentation in the original bill. We were including that language in strike all. Wanted to make that clear. I failed to mention that, but.
Ranking Member Smith, are you good? Any further questions?
Okay, yeah, actually, still the same question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question being, and just for clarification, I was referring to my own notes from the staff analysis on the original bill's definition of reasonably available. So can you just explain to the committee how this definition of direct supervision compares to the original bill? And for practical purposes, the reason I'm trying to understand how much more narrow it is because much of the feedback we received on the bill was on the original bill that was drafted, not
right.
Strike all.
Representative Altman, you're recognized.
Yes, in line 22 through 24, it revises the definition of direct supervision to better represent the current definition adopted by the Florida Department of Health and the Department of Florida Board of Medicine. I read that first paragraph in my first. Let me read the rest so it can give you a clear understanding. The current language we have that we're changing is outdated, unnecessary, and restrictive, and can be problematic. This is very common, the approach we're using here, that is used by other allied health professionals, such as PAs, CRNAs, ARNPs, and this version is basically approved by the licensing agencies and the supervisory components of this bill. So the Board of Medicine, they adapt some of these standards. The Board of Osteopathic Medicine, this is in line with the procedures that they have when they require direct supervision, that require some physical presence of a supervising licensing person on premises, and that the supervising licensing individual is reasonably available. So this is consistent with all those other licensings, allied health professional licenses, So the Board of Medicine and the Board of Osteopathic Medicine is in line with this.
And to try to follow up on Ranking Member Smith's question, so the STRICALL returns the definition to immediately available, which is what it currently is. Is that a fair characterization of what this STRICALL does? It returns the definition, basically with a little bit of cleanup, back to immediately available. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Ranking Member Smith, you look perplexed. You have a question. You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the indulgence. So I believe, Rep. Altman, that you worked with other stakeholders to develop the amendment, including possibly FANA, I believe. Could you speak on behalf of FANA? Do you know, are they supportive of the bill as amended, or are they neutral, or are they opposed?
Representative Altman, you're recognized.
I have had no opposition to the bill that I'm aware of.
Further questions? Ranking Member Smith, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Altman. On line 135 of the STRICALL, it says that the anesthesiologist assistant may personally administer the prescribed anesthetic under direct supervision of the anesthesiologist. Can you speak to how that compares to the practice now, may personally administer, how that changes what's happening right now out there? But also, more broadly, I'm still trying to understand examples, if you can provide them, of under what scenarios can an AA now administer anesthesia compared to what they can do now. What is the change, and what is mm-hmm. what is this disrupting?
Well, the new language.
Oh,
thank you. The new language makes it clear that a CAA may perform the tasks that are listed in statute, and those that are listed in detail in the written protocol under the direct supervision of the anesthesiologist. So anything that the AA the CAA does has to follow that protocol that is written by the anesthesiologist and has the direct supervisory authority over that. So it's not like a CAA can go into an emergency operating room and start administering anesthesia. There's written protocols and there is direct supervision under an anesthesiologist.
Representative Skidmore, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize, Rep. Altman. I am confused between the original bill and the STRICALL and the existing statute in place, protocols that are in place. What is it that we are actually changing when we are and if we adopt the STRICALL amendment?
Okay.
Development, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll walk through it in detail for you. Line 13 adds the term osteopathic as anesthesiologist and can either allopathic or osteopathic physicians can be anesthesiologists. That's line 13. Line 22 through line 24 revises the definition of direct supervision to better represent the current definition defined, adopted by the Florida Department of Health and the Florida Board of Medicine. Similar to, as I mentioned, to what restrictions are placed on PAs, CRNAs, ARNPs. The version is one that the Board of Medicine definition and meets the Board of Medicine rule 64B8-2.001, subparagraph 1A. And that's from the Board of Medicine. And then Florida Administrative Code has a provision as well. Direct supervision shall require the physician's presence of the supervising licensee on the premises so that supervising licensee is reasonably available. And included in that change in 20-24, as the chairman mentioned, further defines immediately available. Again, to close that time to ensure that anesthesiologist is there. Lines 36 through 41, this new language makes it clear that the CAA may perform the tasks listed in statute and those detailed in the written protocol under the direct supervision of an anesthesiologist. The tasks and services detailed in the protocol must be within the framework of the AA's scope of practice and that of the supervising physicians. This is normal. Doctors make decisions for their patients, physicians lead team and their delegate responsibility, and they delegate their responsibility at different levels. We trust, I know I do, I trust our decisions, our physicians to make the right decisions in these very complex medical and clinical decisions. Line 92, 94, and 101, this language is administrative in nature and removes the requirement of a sworn statement during the, as I mentioned earlier, the requirement of sworn statement during the license renewal process, and instead requires acknowledgement be made by the AA. The sworn statement requirement has created problems and delays, especially in the new world of COVID. And I can go further if you'd like, but that really highlights the details and the changes that we made.
Further questions? Seeing none, we'll move into public testimony on the amendment. Lisa Call, Florida Academy of Anesthesiologist Assistants. Sorry, I could not read your handwriting. Sir, you are recognized.
Good morning, distinguished chair and members of the committee. I've had the same handwriting since second grade, so that's okay. My name is Jermaine LeClaire, and I'm the immediate past president of the Florida Academy of Anesthesiologist Assistants. I'm also an associate professor and program director for the largest anesthesiologist assistant program in the country, as well as probably the largest anesthesiologist program for CAAs, with 45 or 47 students in our cohort. I also am treasurer of the ARC-AA, which is the accreditation subarm body who looks at accreditation standards for anesthesiologist assistants. When I think back about 20 years ago, when I first came into this building, knocking on doors, asking legislators to really pull together to create a licensure bill for AAs, I never thought we would come this far. As a young man from Miami-Dade County, more specifically the city of Opa-locka, if I wanted to apply to an anesthesiologist assistant program, I would have had to go to Georgia or Emory. Those were the only two schools and programs at that time. Thanks to the good work that was done by the legislators, and thank you, Representative Altman, for supporting this new bill, your unwavering support, I'm able to stand here today before you as a program director and a certified anesthesiologist assistant who's been practicing for 15 years. I practice at Memorial Regional Hospital, which is probably one of the busiest trauma centers as a trauma anesthetist, where we do everything. So what we have here and what you have present before you this morning is not a departure or a deviation of the current standards in place. What we are seeking to do is modernize and update the bill that was passed 20 years ago so we can make anesthesia effective and safer for our patients. There's no change in our scope of practice. We're still tied to a supervising anesthesiologist through direct supervision. We don't change the types of anesthetics we do in this piece of legislation. Anesthesiologist assistants performs all types of anesthesia, from MAC anesthesia to general anesthesia. I may have a gunshot patient move right into a cardiac case from somebody who's coming from the ICU, who's bleeding into the mediastinum, and put that patient on bypass, and then finish with a colonoscopy or kidney transplant all in the same night. So what this committee needs to know is that Florida is the second most licensed state behind Georgia and is anticipated to grow. We have four programs now in the state of Florida, more than any other state, and also Nova Southeastern University, which has four programs, which I'm a proud faculty member of, will be graduating in 2 years almost 50% of this nation's workforce. for certified anesthesiologist assistants. So certified anesthesiologist assistants, like Representative Altman has alluded to, there are almost 650 of us. Never, ever has a certified anesthesiologist assistant appeared before the Board of Medicine for an encumbrance against their license or any disciplinary action whatsoever. And going back to some of the questions regarding CMS billing or modifiers, there are no changes made in this bill that directly change the way CMS recognizes anesthesiologist assistants. Again, there is no departure or deviation of the standard of care or the scope of practice for certified anesthesiologist assistants or how we take care of our patients. We simply want to be as most effective as we can with the administrative and substantive changes that we have proposed. I hope that answers some of your questions, and I'll be glad to take questions from you.
Since you opened it up, Representative Rayner, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you so much for coming and kind of giving us some more insight. I did have a couple of questions, and so do you want me to go through you? Okay. So the first question I have, especially because you are a professor of this practice area, and I know Representative Altman spoke to this, but if you could kind of walk me through some of the training and education that anesthesiologist assistants have to undergo. How long is the training? How long is the education? Is it a year? Is it 2 years? Is it 3 years? If you could kind of walk me through that so I can have a better understanding.
Sir, you're recognized.
Thank you. Our training is approximately 27 to 28 months. It's a master's degree of science in anesthesiology. That is the degree that we award our graduates at Nova Southeastern University. It may be a master of health science and another at another program. We have 24 to 28 months of didactic and clinical training. We must, by KHEP standards, perform at least 2,000 clinical hours of patient care and anesthesia. There's also a continuing medical education requirement that we must submit every 2 years to the NCCAA, who certifies certified anesthesiologists assistant. So our training is comparable to other non-physician providers who provide anesthesia, and of course, certified anesthesiologist assistants work within the anesthesia care team as a non-physician provider, which is the designation from the American Society of Anesthesiology, which directs how non-physician providers should be connected to an anesthesiologist in the delivery of safe anesthesia care. I hope that answers your question.
Representative Rayner, you're recognized for another question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it does, thank you. So with that in mind, and we're level setting with that, my question would be comparable to the parameters that you have now, how would this bill make it better or make the work that you do more efficient or improve the work that y'all do now compared to what we have in place right now?
Sir, you're recognized.
The current statute doesn't say if I can give a patient a COVID test. Well, people at Walgreens can give somebody a COVID test. You can go pick one up at Walgreens right now and give yourself a COVID test. So that is why we want to make it clear that the work and scope of our practice is in our protocol, and not everything that we do, not every specific surgery or every specific duty that we perform can be written in statute. If it was, I don't know how many pages you would have it there, but it would be an abundance of minutia. But what this bill does, again, is clearly articulates in the protocol what we can do as directed by our anesthesiologist. We come up with this protocol together. You can't have an anesthesiologist tell you to go do something and you can't perform that specific action because you aren't trained to do it. The protocol is developed in concert with the anesthesiologist assistant and the physician, the anesthesiologist. This directs the way we practice. And so, this is the same. This is a precedent, of course, that's the same for PAs, for nurse practitioners. We are considered an airway expert, and there was a question about reasonably available. What does that mean? What does reasonably available mean? Or what does immediately available mean? Well, it means if a trauma comes in and I'm doing a trauma case and my anesthesiologist is helping me, but all of a sudden there's a C-section and the baby is anoxic or hypoxic, he may have to go over there and help with that case. I need to be able to call him and say, listen, I need your help. But it gives us the latitude because this is the way medicine works. We are here to save lives, and it gives us the ability to make a differential diagnosis, which we are trained to do. The anesthesiologist is not holding our hand in the operating room for 2 hours while the case is going on. We're trained to make important decisions, life-saving, and give life-saving emergency help in those times. And that is the meaning besides reasonably available. Now, there was a suggestion made in the strike all, and I'll go back to this, where it was suggested that we put immediately available in there. The Board of Medicine has set a precedent defining the supervising physician on premises, which we've kept, but we've also tightened it up a little bit and said we're not going to go with the precedent of reasonably available. We said immediately available is fine for us. And so that's what we've gone with.
President Rayner, you're welcome for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, sir, you actually just answered my next question about the reasonably versus immediately available. I do thank you so much for your willingness to answer questions. I'll yield.
Further questions for the great professor. Ranking Member Smith, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony so far. And again, just for clarification, the reasonably available language is no longer in the underlying bill if we adopt the strike all, just for clarification. So we're going back to immediately available. So my question is the direct supervision situation being changed in a way that an AA can administer anesthesia on one floor of a facility or another floor of a facility as long as there's an anesthesiologist who is there in the facility, that would now, I guess, meet this definition of immediately available? Can AAs not administer if they're in a separate suite from a supervising anesthesiologist, and that is what this language is now clarifying, that they don't have to be in the same suite? I'm hearing confusion from members here on what this bill actually does and changes, especially if we're as it relates to actual administration of anesthesia, if we're not changing the level of supervision.
Sir, you're recognized.
When the bill was first drafted, the language was used, I believe, contiguous suite. And there has been some, that's been quite abstract. What is a contiguous suite? Is it next door? Is it within the same ICU? Is it within the hospital? The way in which we work is that an anesthesiologist is 100% always available. 100%. What this does is modernizes the language to say he has to be on the premises because I may be doing a case on the third floor. We don't have all of the anesthesia delivery sites on the same floor. It's impossible in a major hospital. It's impossible at an acute care center, especially at a level one trauma center. If you go to a surgery center, maybe. But what this does is it modernizes language. It keeps immediately available that the anesthesiologist assistant is always in contact with the anesthesiologist. It does not allow for a departure from what we are doing now. We're going to be doing the same work, same scope of practice that we're doing now. That answers your question.
Further questions? Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. Thank you for standing up there.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. Sir, can you pronounce your last name again?
LeClaire.
LeClaire.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Brecht Huchin, anesthesiologist assistants. Waves in support. Members, we are in debate on the amendment. Seeing no debate, Representative Altman, you're recognized to close on your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to be a lot more comfortable knowing we have people like Dr. LeClaire the next time I have my next colonoscopy training, the professionals that are helping. So one thing I did not mention is this is a care extender. You know, access to health care is extremely important, from high quality care, the best possible medical care that we can give, to the cost of care. Neither one of those are being compromised. They're going to be augmented from this bill. This is a great bill. It's going to provide a higher quality of care, and it's going to provide more access to care. When I close.
Without objection, please show that amendment adopted. So we are back on the main bill as amended, and we have some public appearance cards. Philip Suderman, Americans for Prosperity, waves in support. Mary Thomas, Florida Medical Association, waves in support. Steve Wynn, Florida Osteopathic Medical Association, waves in support. Jermaine LeClerc is a proponent. Do you wish to speak again? Probably not. You're waving in support. And Breck Hukin, you're waving in support. Members, we are in debate on the bill. Representative Rainer, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Rep. Altman, I got to be honest, I walked in here today prepared to vote against this bill. And Dr. LeClerc, who I jokingly said to one of my colleagues, maybe you should have had him present the bill, he really was able to explain it as a practitioner. I think that it's not lost on a lot of folks. I don't really like scope of practice bills. I like, you know, things to kind of remain the same. But listening to Mr. LeClerc, or is it Dr. or Mr.? Okay, I just want to make sure I like to give people their titles. As listening to him and kind of explaining through what this bill would do, I feel a little bit more comfortable. I know that this does have another stop in Health and Human Services, so I'm hoping that some of the concerns that my other colleagues may have can get ironed out. But I will be up on this bill today, and that's really due in part to Mr. LeClerc, so maybe you should bring him to the next committee stop as well. And that kind of gave me a little bit more comfort in voting yes for this bill.
Representative Rizzo, you recognize in debate.
Thank you, Chair. Rep, the amendment really took care of my concern, and I think it really straightened out everything that we had some questions about, certainly that I had questions about. It is my understanding that with the Board of Medicine and everything else, that certainly any concern that I had is totally assuaged. Thank you.
Representative Maggard, you recognize in debate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Altman, for bringing this bill to us. Diving into this bill and talking to the anesthesiologist assistants, it took me a while to even say the word, much less. We got to come up with an acronym or something, but. Their passion and what they do for us that sometimes we don't even know, is amazing. And I think this is a great bill to help them out, and I think it's a great bill to help the citizens of Florida out. So thank you so much for bringing it.
Representative Escamani, you recognize in debate.
Thank you so much, Chair. And Representative Altman, the amendment
really helped me a lot. And so I'll be voting yes on your bill. And also just for the staff to know too, I was still reading your PCS when it was up here. So I also liked the previous bill. So I want to change my vote on that too. And I'll talk to staff one-on-one. So that is two yes Gamanis for Representative Thad Altman today. So I appreciate you.
Ranking Member Smith, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Altman, for working with us to try to clarify confusion here. I mean, that again, your strike all, which was, of course, adopted, reverts back to the immediately available. It doesn't appear to change scope. Obviously, we heard from FMA and other physicians in support. And to me, while I still have some questions about other potential impacts around the bill, I'm gonna have to work with other stakeholders to figure out if those concerns still exist. Because the question of if those concerns still exist are ones that I need to work out with them. So I'm going to vote up on the bill. I appreciate you working with committee staff and with Chair Robinson to make sure that we were more comfortable with the proposal. And I thank you for bringing this forward.
Further debate. Representative Altman, you're recognized to close in your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate all the input and the questions, and especially the professional input. I want to correct one thing. It doesn't revert back to the old language. The old language that was problematic is the term present. It required that there be a presence in the surgical suite. That was a problem. It really sort of was counter to the idea of having a health extender. So obviously reasonable wasn't enough for you guys. I liked it, but I respect the wish of the committee, and you come up with a really good term, immediate. So that those are the changes and pretty much the essence of the bill.
Representative Altman, having closed in his bill, Aaron, please call the roll on HB 1101 and announce the vote.
Representatives Andrade?
Yes.
Arrington?
Yes.
Barrero?
Yes.
Escamani?
Yes.
Fernandez-Barkin?
Yes.
Garrison?
Yes.
Gottlieb?
Yes.
Maggard?
Yes.
McLean?
Yes.
Rayner?
Yes.
Rizzo?
Yes.
Rommel?
Yes.
Saroy?
Yes.
Skidmore?
Yes.
Smith?
Yes.
Snyder?
Yes.
Tuck?
Yes.
Chair Robinson?
Yes.
18 yeas and 0 nays, Mr. Chairman.
We show the bill reported favorably as amended. Congratulations. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you to the committee.
Next up for consideration by the subcommittee, House Bill 1521, Professional Counselors Licensure Compact by Representative Koster. Representative, you are recognized to explain your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair, and committee. House Bill 1521 is the Professional Counselors Licensure Compact that will allow qualified professional counselors to practice in all states that join the compact. This will remove the need for these counselors to obtain separate licensure in each state in which they want to practice. The counseling compact is the same in form and function as other occupational licensure compacts, like the nurse licensure compact that's been adopted here in Florida. The counseling compact authorizes interstate practice both in person and through telehealth by professional counselors who hold a valid, unrestricted license in their compact member state. The compact will improve access to professional counseling services. It'll increase market opportunities for these professional counselors to authorize them to practice in member states, including via telehealth, and it'll also offer continuity of care for their patients who may travel or relocate to another state. That is the bill, Mr. Chair.
Members, any questions on the bill? Seeing none, we have two amendments. You are recognized to explain amendment barcode 567287.
Thank you, Chair. This amendment removes reference to Chapter 491 from the compact language and provides for a separate definition of licensed professional counselor in Chapter 491.
Any questions for members on the amendment? We have no public testimony. Any debate? Need to close?
I'll waive close, Chair.
Having waived close, please show the amendment adopted. We're moving on to the second amendment. You're recognized, Representative, to explain amendment barcode 368103.
Thank you, Chair, and because it's Groundhog's Day, I'll say literally the same thing. This amendment also removes a reference to Chapter 491 from the compact and then defines professional licensed professional counselor within Chapter 491.
Any member questions? Seeing none, we have no public debate or public testimony. Any debate? Seeing none.
I'll waive close.
Waive and close. Please show the amendment adopted without objection. We're back on the main bill as amended, and we'll move into public testimony. Corinne Mixon of the Florida Mental Health Counselors Association waves in support. Philip Sutterman, Americans for Prosperity, he is in support. Members, we are in debate. Seeing no debate, Representative, you're recognized to close in your bill.
Thank you, Chair. Typically, when a bill goes through so smoothly, I would waive close, but this one's really important to me. And you know, I think that it's widely recognized we've got an access issue with mental health providers, and the pandemic has not only highlighted the need for more mental health treatment, but it's exacerbated that need. And in my private career as a family law attorney, I see all too often my clients having trouble finding a mental health provider for themselves or their children. We've recently witnessed one of our most decorated Olympic athletes come out and speak on mental health and wellness issues that she's facing herself. And just this Monday, we lost, tragically, 2019 Miss America to suicide. So it's incredibly important. We need to continue talking about this issue. We need to continue working to break the stigma surrounding mental health. But the stigma is only one piece of the puzzle, and the access to the treatment that these people need is the major piece of the puzzle. And this bill will help increase the access to Floridians to the mental health treatment that they need. And with that, I ask for your favorable support.
Erin, please call the roll on HB 1521 and announce the vote.
Representatives Andrade?
Yes.
Arrington?
Yes.
Ferrero?
Yes.
Escamani?
Yes.
Hernandez-Barkin?
Yes.
Garrison?
Yes.
Gottlieb?
Yes.
Maggard?
Yes.
McLean?
Yes.
Rayner?
Yes.
Rizzo?
Yes.
Rommel?
Yes.
Saroy?
Yes.
Skidmore?
Yes.
Smith?
Yes.
Snyder?
Yes.
Tuck?
Yes.
Chair Robinson?
Yes.
18 yeas and zero nays, Mr. Chairman.
Please show the bill reported favorably as amended. Congratulations.
Thank you, Chair.
Moving on, Representative Koster, you're recognized to explain House Bill 1523, Public Records and Meetings, Professional Counselors.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the adhering public record exemption bill for the bill that we just heard. This public record exemption was drafted to mirror the nurse licensure compact public record exemption that passed the legislature in previous years. That is the bill, Mr. Chair.
Do we have any questions on the bill from the members? Seeing none, we do have one public appearance card. Philip Suderman, Americans for Prosperity, waves in support. Members, we are on debate. Seeing no debate, Representative Koster, you recognize to close in your bill.
I'll waive close on this.
Having waived close, Erin, please call the roll on HB 1523 and announce the vote.
Representatives Andrade?
Yes.
Arrington?
Yes.
Ferrero?
Yes.
Escamani?
Yes.
Hernandez-Barkin?
Yes.
Garrison?
Yes.
Gottlieb?
Yes.
Maggard?
Yes.
McLean?
Yes.
Rayner?
Yes.
Rizzo?
Yes.
Rommel?
Yes.
Saroy?
Yes.
Skidmore?
Yes.
Smith?
Yes.
Snyder?
Yes.
Tuck?
Yes.
Chair Robinson?
Yes.
18 yeas and zero nays, Mr. Chairman.
Please show the bill reported favorably. Congratulations.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Committee.
Last but not least, House Bill 1209, Administration of Vaccines. Our very own Representative Tuck, you're recognized to explain your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good afternoon, Committee. From the start of the pandemic, pharmacists, pharmacy interns, and registered pharmacy technicians have been on the front lines, not only giving Floridians vaccines and boosters, but also meeting a full range of other healthcare needs. With that in mind, HB 1209 would codify portions of the Public Readiness and Emergency Preparedness Act, or PREP Act. The proposal would allow registered pharmacy technicians to administer vaccines to adults ages 18 and over. Registered pharmacy technicians are currently administering vaccines under the PrEP Act and have been trained according to guidelines issued by the Department of Health and Human Services and approved by the Accreditation Council for Pharmacy Education. This bill mirrors the current training requirements of the PrEP Act by requiring 6 hours of immunization-related training and approved by the Board of Pharmacy and 2 additional hours of continuing education. Registered pharmacy technicians may only administer vaccines under supervision of immunizing pharmacists, and that is the bill, Mr. Chair.
Representative Tuck, having explained the bill, any questions for members? Seeing none, we have an amendment. Please explain. You are recognized to explain barcode amendment 913487.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This amendment is clarifying in nature and does not change the intent of the bill. It makes clear that registered pharmacy technicians must be certified rather than only trained, and it removes the pharmacy to registered pharmacist to registered pharmacy tech ratio, meaning the Board of Pharmacy has oversight over that still.
Any questions on the amendment? Representative Soroy, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Tuck, am I correct in understanding that your amendment would require a pharmacy technician to complete a certification course that is offered by the Board of Medicine?
Representative Tuck, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe I understand your question correctly. The pharmacy techs must be certified in order to administer the vaccines, and there is a sort of certification course.
Representative Soroy, you're recognized for follow-up or clarification.
So just to clarify, the Board of Medicine consults with the Board of Pharmacy in offering this training, but it's actually the Board of Medicine that provides the training.
Representative Tuck, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There is someone here who could speak to that, but I believe that's my understanding as well.
Thank you.
Further questions? Seeing none, we don't have any public testimony, any member debate on the amendment. Representative, would you like to close in your amendment?
Wave close.
Please show the amendment adopted without objection. We're back on the main bill. We do have some public appearance cards. Claudia Durant, Florida Pharmacy Association. Ma'am, you're recognized.
Hi, I'm Claudia Devan. I represent the Florida Pharmacy Association, and we appreciate the Delete Everything amendment that the sponsor presented. And it does take care of some of our concerns, but we look forward to working with the sponsor on some additional concerns that we have.
Thank you. Michael Jackson, Florida Pharmacy Association. Sir, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members of the committee, for allowing us to share our thoughts with you on this. And we think this is a great bill. We want to work with Representative Tuck to make it even better. And I also want to give a shout out to all my pharmacist colleagues out there who are working us through this pandemic. They've been administering lots and lots of vaccines these days, and working with technicians can help us increase capacity and do things like improve safety and develop access. There are couple of tweaks that I think we need to work on this particular issue to make things even better, and we hope that in the next stop we'll have an opportunity to do that. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Grace Lovett, Florida Retail Federation. You're recognized.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Tuck, for bringing this bill forward. I believe it celebrates and recognizes all the work that pharmacies, pharmacists, pharmacy interns, techs have been doing during this emergency, and it is just recognizing that techs are already giving shots now under the PrEP Act, and we wanted to codify that for adults only, that techs would also be able to administer vaccines. I do want to answer the question earlier about the training. The training is approved by the Board of Pharmacy, but there are several providers. Pharmacists, interns, techs all have various different number of hours, different kinds of training, continuing ed, and they're all provided from a variety of different providers. I hope that helps. And I'll take any other questions.
Thank you. Seeing no questions, appreciate it.
Thank you.
Jake Farmer, Walgreens, waves in support. Philip Suderman, Americans for Prosperity, waves in support. Greg Black, National Association of Chain Drugstore, waves in support. Megan Fay, CVS Health and all affiliates, waves in support. Robert Blair, Walmart, waves in support. That's all the public testimony I have. Members, we are in debate. Representative Soroy, you're recognized in debate.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the sponsors' indulgence of my many questions and the time that we spent together talking about it, and I look forward to continuing those conversations and encourage members to support this bill.
Further debate. Representative Tuck, you're recognized to close in your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, I think we can all appreciate the need for access to what could be a life-saving vaccine, and this bill only furthers that goal. And I look forward to working with everybody to make this bill even better. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Aaron, please call the roll on HB 1209 and announce the vote.
Representatives Andrade?
Yes.
Arrington?
Yes.
Barrero?
Yes.
Escamani?
Yes.
Hernandez-Barkin?
Yes.
Garrison?
Yes.
Gottlieb?
Yes.
Maggard?
Yes.
McLean?
Yes.
Rayner?
Yes.
Rizzo?
Yes.
Rommel?
Yes.
Soroy?
Yes.
Skidmore?
No.
Smith?
Yes.
Snyder?
Yes.
Tuck?
Yes.
Chair Robinson?
Yes.
17 yeas and one nay, Mr. Chairman.
Please show the bill reported favorably as amended. I do have to say I was a little bit disappointed with Representative Escamani changing her vote, because I think we were poised to have history here, a split vote between Representative Escamani and Smith. I don't know if the legislature had seen that before, but I guess we'll have to wait for the next time. So with that, this concludes our subcommittee agenda. Representative Escamani moves we rise. Unless there's an objection upon the motion, Representative Escamani, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.
No objection.